So we always say what we remind ourselves. We say Chazara ala Mishnah. Go back and learn the Mishnah again, or we back and remind ourselves about our Mishnah. It's important that we have our Mishnah in mind every time we launch into any Gemara that's going to come to explicate it. So our Mishnah begins. It's on 73b4, if you have the Art Scroll Gemara. It's the first Mishnah in chapter 8 of Yoma. Yom HaKippurim, on Yom Kippur, we had mentioned that it didn't deal with Arve Yom Kippurim, right? Didn't deal with the ninth day. We talked about the ninth day, but we're right on to the Inuyem Nefesh that we're going to see. Yom HaKippurim Asur Ba'achila V'shtia Uv'rechitzo V'sicho V'nilara Sandal V'tashmish Amita. So it's forbidden to eat, to drink, wash, anoint, wear a sandal, and make good use of the bed. And so, all of that is asur, except, let's just qualify that, the new mother and the king can wash their face, and the one who gave birth, Tin Ol et Asandal, Divrei Rabbi Eliezer. That's Rabbi Eliezer's position. The Chachamim Osrim, and the sages forbid it. Now on to figuring out whether or not any amount of eating at all is absolutely forbidden. Ha'ochel kechotevet hagasa chamoha uchagri anata v'ashotem malei lugmav chayav. So if you eat the dates bulk of food or the cheeks full of mayim or liquid you drink, you're obligated. In other words, you're chayav karet. You're obligated for the punishment of being completely cut off from your people. Kol ha'ochlin mitzarfin l'chol chatevet v'chol ha'mashkin mitzarfin l'malei lugmav. So if you eat in small portions and you say, I'm getting away with it because I'm eating in small portions, forget it. It all adds up to the specific weight that's specified in the Mishnah. And if you eat up to that amount, you're what? It seems like you're okay. But you can have half a cheek filled, and you can have half of the dates bulk, and they don't come together to make a date cheek or a cheeky date or whatever it is. They don't come together. There's no combining them. Now, the word that we were interested in terms of where we left off, was the word asur. Why does the Mishnah start with asur, and what did we say? Because it's forbidding derabanan instead of deraita by the Torah's rule. It's forbidding on the level of derabanan the eating of any small amount vis-a-vis the achila and the shtia particularly that's in the Mishnah, the eating and the drinking. And we said, just so we can put it in the greater context of Jewish experience with Yom Kippur, we said, we know we're supposed to fast on Yom Kippur. And by us, when we say fast, I think what we mean is both eating and drinking, refraining from both. Right? Am I right? People would include that naturally, right?
Jews
would. Right. So it's the experience of the Jewish people that we're talking about. And so, we're interested in this word asur, as the Gemara is interested in this word asur. The Gemara, as I explained, began with an exploration of whether or not something is deraita or derabanan, because there is some recognition that when we fulfill the commandments that are in any given Mishnah, we literally live out words of Torah. That's deraita. I'm following something deraita. I'm following something that the Torah has told me to do. I'm listening to the rabbis tell me that it is deraita. It is interpreted to be Torah coming to life in my life, my observing it, I'm also reminded, by way of the reality of what's unfolding on the pages of Gemara, that derabbanan, I have pledged my allegiance to rabbinic authority. And so I like to say, we are not Torah Jews, we're rabbinic Jews. We're rabbinic Jews who live out Torah sometimes, and this has become actually a little bit of a debate in modern times. Is Torah Judaism the truest Judaism? What does that mean when you say Torah Judaism versus really rabbinic Judaism with all of its, what we like to say sometimes, is the grayness of living in shades of gray that you can really take and uphold as part of the rabbinic world of halachic dialogue and decision-making. And this, at its core, is introduced conceptually by the Gemara arguing about a very specific point of law. And what's essential for us as readers of Talmud and as students of Gemara is that we have in mind the more conceptual frameworks of what the approach is, en large, rabbinic versus Torahidic system of mitzvot that was created, and how that pertains to the most sacred day of our year, to the Shabbat Shabbaton, to the fast, that again, now I'll say conceptually, and in terms of ritual studies, we'll recognize that maybe it didn't have to be a fast at all. Who said it had to be a fast? We read the Torah Pesukim together. De'araita, it said la'anot et nashoteichem, the verb la'anot being the inui, being the affliction. But it didn't say la'anot et nashoteichem batzom. It didn't say afflict your souls with a fast. It didn't say that at all in the Bamidbar passage, nor in the Levitical passages that talk about the holiday. That's going to be important for us today, because some of what we're going to encounter in terms of Braita, I want you not just to see that it's an interpretation, a game of let's throw up a straw man and say it could have been this. No, it's really that. Now, that is a hermeneutical kind of move. Let's take it as there was really debate in the era of the Tanaim as to just what it meant in Torah to have a Yom Kippur, to experience Yom Kippur, and what the other possibilities are. And then we're going to deepen that, and we're going to see thematically what comes out of the exploration of whether or not to afflict your soul really does mean fast and don't eat, don't drink, or these other possibilities of what it could mean. And we're going to then look at an article that traces some of the history of perhaps why or where from we understand fasting was an essential component of it, and ask ourselves whether the Pharisees and the rabbis adopted this and took this, or it was just as prevalent by the rabbis and the Pharisees, right? Pharisees being the name we give to the proto-rabbinite Jews of the rabbinic era. Pharisees, Pharisaic movement. There's debate in that as well. We can leave that debate aside for another time and talk about that in a different way. You know, were the Pharisees the same as Chazal, as the rabbis and as the sages, or were they a little different? This is a conversation between Professor Neusner and Menachem Elon and some of the other biggies from Hebrew U. And so we'll put that over there for a minute. But generally it's thought the Pharisees and the Sadducees were the groups, the priestly group Sadducee, the Pharisees, pre-rabbis. They were around during the time of the temple. And so too, and I'll just kind of foreshadow where we're going with that article and what that article is going to trace. We're going to look at some of the Qumran practices that were very, very interesting religious practices that, even though that group was small, might have made a very big impact, a bigger impact than we think of today even, on rabbinic Judaism than previously thought about.
Did the Karaites do anything significantly different?
So that's interesting too. Are Karaites, capital K, Karaites proper during that time?
Well, no, later.
They're later, but are there proto-Karaitic groups at work as well that I shouldn't forget when I say Qumran. So we're going to look at Karaites being very much simple sense of the text kind of legal interpreters of the Torah, but also, again, a community that has their own interpretation, even though people like to think of the Karaites as being like to the word of the law as it's written in the Torah. They have their own interpretations, and they have the proto-Karaitic groups have their own practices going at that time as well. So we're going to look at an article that traces a little bit of that history towards the end of the night. That's where we're headed tonight. So let's look at some text. Turn with me to page 70... 74A2. So we're on 74 Aleph, Ayin Dalet Aleph. I'm going to start with V'chol Hecha. So V'chol Hecha is about the middle of the page if you're in the Hebrew lines. And it's on line 11. The way if you're following the Vilna, I'll just show you quickly. Is anybody using the Vilna page? I don't know, maybe you'll see it there, Ron. If you have it there, it's basically 11 lines down, so it'll be wherever. I don't know if 11 corresponds to Steinsaltz's layout. Yeah. Okay, so. On the inside box, it's the 11th line. The Chol Hecha. And then on the 74A2, it's in the left-hand column closest to the gutter. The Chol Hecha d'tane anush karet lo tane asur. Now the Gemara is going to go and start telling you about how sins that are punishable by karet being cut off entirely should never, or the Brisa is suggesting, should never, or are never, or wait a minute, what's going on here, that you're teaching the term asur, basically forbidden, asur, that it's forbidden, and not teaching chayav, that you're totally obligated to the punishment if you do any of these. 100% obligated, meaning you're going to be punished. So don't do these. Asur sounds like it may be a little bit more flexible to the ear of the editor of the Gemara and the halachic parlance that's being discussed here. If it's got karet, you shouldn't really be hearing the word asur. V'hatanya, but it was taught in the Braita being a source from the age of the Tanaim, that's not in the Mishnah, maybe Tosefta, most likely not, collection of Braita that are really outside the Tanaitic books that we know. Even though they said it's prohibited on Yom Kippur to engage in all of them, meaning the different activities of our Mishnah, right? Keeping in mind, achila, shtia, right? Washing, anointing, wearing the sandal, use of the bed. Lo amru anush karet ela ha'ochel v'shote v'osei malacha. Karet really only applies to two of those five that are on my list, according to the Mishnah, meaning karet is for eating and drinking, and another category that we didn't get in the Mishnah per se, osei melacha. Transgressing one of the prescribed works or categories of work that are forbidden to you on any given Shabbat or Yom Tov. Now, those categories of work immediately for the kind of student of the sources takes you immediately zoop, to chapter 7 of Shabbat in the Mishnah. There are 40 less one categories of malachot, of work, of labors that we do not commit we do not trespass on the Sabbath. 39 of them. They deal with everything from the world of agriculture and harvesting to the world of preparing deer skin for all its uses in the ancient world, to lighting a fire, which is said explicitly in terms of the Torah, and it's the only one that seems to be really explicit, right? Lo tavaru eish, you shall not light a fire in your dwelling place. If there's any kind of Shabbat law, by the way, that we know directly from Torah, that we should really, really take seriously, even though the rabbis say the entirety of Sabbath laws are like a mountain standing on a hair, right? That's the famous quip that they have about Sabbath laws. There's one that's explicit, Lo tvar ruesh, don't light a fire. And some people will come and ask me, isn't it okay if I just light my candles an hour after Sabbath time? And I'll say, listen, the Torah says it pretty straightforwardly. It's the one rule we have. It's the one law. Don't light a fire. You know, so what can I say? That's the one that seems to me the most connected to Torah for you. And most people are still really connected to the Torah, if they're not, to all of the corpus of rabbinic law. So I help people work out. I'm like, oh, so what do? I'm going to get home late. Well, A, someone in the household could light candles in a sink. You can come in, cover your eyes, and bless the lit candles. That's one. And two, make a case for electric candlelights that go on a timer at candlelighting time. And if that's the only electric light, if electric light is the only light you can really muster, use the electric set. We for sure allow for an electric set and other than you know, like real candles in hospitals or hotels. And that was already an answer of Rabbi Moshe Feinstein. Not just some newfangled modern look at the world through the Reform Committee on Jewish Practice or the Conservative Committee on Jewish Law and Standards. So that's real in our time. But the idea and the hope was that people would at least take seriously the very explicit commandment in the Torah when it came to Sabbath practice. And on top of that, the rabbis didn't include that as number one in the list of 39. They got to it at around, you know, like 28, 29, or 30, 31 to tell you that all of these have great, great power, possibility, and legal jurisdiction in your life. And we're creating this entire list for you in order to create the possibility for Shabbat and Shabbat culture. That's how one way we've discussed those. And Malacha is added here to remind you that Yom Kippur is beyond its status as the fast day and the day that you don't anoint yourself and don't bathe and you wear your Yom Kippur shoes. It's like Shabbat. It's like Yom Tov. Even when it doesn't fall on Shabbat, and you don't do any of the malachot that you wouldn't do on the Sabbath. And that creates for the Braita here the possibility to tell you what karet is really for. Now, karet's really interesting because it can lead to complete exclusion among your people and then ultimately death by beitin. The shemayim, God, in God's hand, is your untimely demise. But what it's really saying, karet, is that you're not in the game. You know, you're not in the game. You got to be in the game. I just was studying for an hour with one of our teens, and she said to me, "I don't understand why I can sort out a couple of things in my room, but I can't take apart a pile of berries and take the ones out that I like and leave the rest, because we have this malacha." This major work category of Borer. Can't separate the good from the bad. And if in her mind the good is blueberry, but the bad is raspberry and strawberry, that's asur. That's forbidden. So we got to talking about the whole concept of it creating this link to ancient heritage and ancient agriculture and the way that people express their choices in the world versus understanding the godly beauty, bounty of having a bowl full of berries, all of this, right? But it's a matter of consciously being in the game. You can really either buy that, or you can really say, like, wow. To the point of, and this is for real, not a throwaway, worries that some type of interaction with this code of law is a little bit like a presentation of OCD. And there are articles in journals and books about our relationship to the law explaining to practitioners that this is seeking deeply spiritual and religious exploration of living in time and space of the world through Jewish lenses and Jewish ways and means, and shouldn't concern you, practitioner, diagnostician, that this is an OCD way of life. Because some people feel a little bit oppressed like that, or could. Perhaps the combination of a clinician and clergy would be the best approach to helping someone through the spiritual struggle if he or she really wants to do that kind of work, right? So that's a very interesting dialogue going on in and among modern Jews, especially, who have the world of possibility about them, and they're no longer like, you know, living in ghettos and only can live in the Jewish community, and if you got excommunicated from the Jewish community, you would be worried. Right? That is ultimately the moment of freedom and citizenship, you know, kind of frees us up for that. Bringing it back to here, the question of all of the rules and laws about Yom Kippur could be asked this way in ritual studies. Are these rituals the most likely glue that really keep the community together and have us practice something together and understand some messages about the central pillars of our faith if we do these practices together? About Yom Kippur particularly, I think that's some of the motivating question for the rabbis. Are these practices ones that work to create a socially cohesive group of people, a la, we were just talking about Durkheim, or mentioning him. Durkheim, who said, you know, that the religious community is, after all, a social community. And he was criticized for his extremism that way, but that aside, right? And you know, a la Eliot and experience of the holy, are these the ones that will remind you most of the pillars of Jewish commitment, faith, pursuit, relationship to God, what our lives are really about? Because if Yom Kippur is supposed to be that kind of a day, we need rituals that will reflect the kind of powerful components of who we are as a Jewish people. Every ritual has the possibility to potentially unlock some of that meaning. Just before we even get two lines in, think about whether or not those rituals really connect you to any of those great pillars of our tradition and what our tradition is really all about as we move forward here, because we're going to see, as I said, unfold different themes that come out in the debates about what the rituals are that we're supposed to actually do on Yom Kippur. So we'll move on. So we just read, V'chol heich d'tani anush karet lo tani asur, anywhere where I have the punishment of karet being cut off, taught, I don't want to see really, how could I possibly see the word asur that's only forbidden? I got to really make sure people know that they're obligated for this, because they're going to be cut off from their people if they transgress. The Hatanya, Afal Pisha Amru Asar B'chulan, even though in our Mishnah everything is forbidden, including all five of the afflictions that are listed. What do I have? Lo Amru Anush Kared Ela Al Ochel V'Shoteva Onesh Malacha. I have to focus in clearly on what is at issue with being cut off with Karet as the punishment. That is eating, drinking, and Malacha Bilvad. Only those. Gemara now comes along and says, Hachi Ka'amar. So the Braita is really saying this. Keshe Amru Asur. When they said the word Asur in the Mishnah, meaning forbidden, and not Chayav, you're obligated to the punishment of Karet, Lo Amru Ela V'chatzi Shi'or. They were only saying that about half the measure of what you can eat and what you can drink. Aval Keshi'or Anush Karet. But if you ate the whole measure, for sure, Karet kicks in. So, remember, I can make a distinction. Derabanan and Deraita. Deraita, you better not eat that amount that would suffice to say that you've transgressed. I eat half of it. Sounds like it's permissible? No. Derabanan, it's asur. I accept that the rabbis make a fence around the Torah and forbid me from eating half the measure. V'afal pisha anush karet. And even though the full measure is punishable by karet, ein anush karet ela ochel v'shoteva osem alacha bilvat. There's no activity punishable by karet except eating, drinking, or performing a prohibited labor. And therefore the Braita does not use the term prohibited with reference to eating or drinking, which are punishable by karet, and so our Gemara's original question was justified. Now, the Gemara is going to present a different solution here, the e-bite image, but you might want to say this. Ki katani asur. Asha'ara. When our Mishnah states prohibited, it really is only is teaching it in regard to the other afflictions. Meaning, it's not really relating to eating and drinking. We know that those are what? Punishable by karet. Here, what I'm really teaching you about is that what's asur is washing, anointing, and using the bed. And that word asur is used, and happens to be that eating and drinking is there too. Ditani Rava of Rav Yosef b'shar sifrei devei Rav. And that Rava and Rav Yosef taught in a braita found in the other books of the academies. What are the other books of the academies? The other books of the academies refer to books they called Sifrei, which are the Midrashim, the halachic, many times halachic Midrashim, explorations of the books of Numbers and Deuteronomy. One we call Sifra these days, and one we call Sifrei. But they knew those books already in the academies of Babylonia. And those were, hermeneutically, they sounded a little like Talmudic reasoning and logic, but sometimes they could be a little different in their presentation of halachic decision-making and decoding and development of ideas. And they knew from there already, according to this, that the Braita, they taught a Braita found in the other books of the academies. And that is, Minayin l'yom ha-kippurim she'asur b'richitza Basicha uvenilada sandala uvetashmi shamita. From where is the source? What is our source for knowing that on Yom Kippur it's forbidden to wash and to anoint and to wear a sandal and to use the bed? Talmud Lomar. The text says, right? It's not the word Talmud as in the entire Talmud. It's the text. I bring you a text and it says Shabbaton. Ah, because it said the duplication of language, Shabbat, Shabbaton, about Yom Kippur, I take the duplication, not only Shabbat, but it's the big Shabbaton, and from that word, Shabbaton, I understand Shvot. I understand that conceptually, I have to find afflictions that are centered philosophically in terms of the philosophy of action here, that's a deeper level of here, in refraining from engaging in pleasurable activities.
So why did Joe chose those five?
So tell me now. I asked you other questions. What If I had to map these afflictions that we do, no eating, no drinking, no washing, no anointing, no wearing sandals, and no use of the bed. If I had to map those onto Jewish values, and we did the exercise of mapping those rituals onto Jewish principles, values, core ideas in Judaism, let's generate some of those now, right? So why? Why might those be the ones? Pick one and map it onto something, or tell me two?
Well, the bed is a bit strange, actually. Yeah, I mean, you've got that. On the other hand, you have the fact that sex can be not so pure under certain circumstances, and all of the things that were cautioned against doing sexually. I could easily see it going in either category, and in fact, as I understand it, the tradition on Shabbat was to have sex.
Oh, no doubt about it, and it got really, big, big time attention. 16th century Tzfat, mystical.
So if this is the Shabbat Shabbaton.
I'll get to you in a second, Dale. Or do you have on the bed?
No, just a clarification. When you were saying Shabbaton, is that different from Shabbat?
Well, it says Shabbat Shabbaton about the Sabbath, and it says Shabbat Shabbaton about Yom Kippur. We're exploring right now what that word really even means. And part of it is that what it means here is that I know that I can trace, or at least this Braita says, about anointing and about washing and about wearing a sandal and about using the bed, I'm going to use that word to learn these things. Now, is there a direct connection between the root of that word and those specific kind of items that I refrain from? Not really, except to say Shabbaton is used here as the asmachta, as what to hang your hat on. I'm going to use this term, Shabbat Shabbaton, to tell me something unique. This is what it's telling me. Back to the double edge of the bed. Perhaps the double-edgedness is inherent in the Yom Kippur experience. On the one hand, it's about being fruitful and multiply, and that bountiful human existence that we're granted and that we're commanded to produce offspring and dor vador, a covenantal promise spoke of on Shabbat, by the way, with Abraham. What was so unique about the covenant between God and Abraham? It was between God, Abraham, and generations to come. Unique in the world, versus a covenant of just with Adam and Eve, or just with Noah. On the other hand, it could represent the possibility of sin, and of, the animal soul taking over, and impurity, and sex at the wrong time. And so it's about also that kind of element of human life fraught with the possibility that you're not living up to the kedusha, the holiness factor that's in it. It's why we have the Levitical reading we do on the afternoon of Yom Kippur, because the Levitical reading about keeping relationships in their purest form according to the way Torah understands it is really all about the element of our sexuality being expressed in the deepest and holiest way that we can. It's that pursuit. Regardless of whether the simple sense of the text is or is not quote-unquote up to speed and current based on interpretation, because that's the way Torah works in our life for thousands of years. We're constantly interpreting and reinterpreting.
Well, if the holiest expression is not to do it, you're only a step away from celibacy.
Ah, but once you get up from Yom Kippur, having reflected on the possibility, there might be those who say, could be a nice first act of the year.
Along the lines of what Barry said on so I'm going to the eating and the drinking, so for Shabbat, you're supposed to eat a special meal, right?
Yeah, three of them.
At night, and then
lunch and then yeah. Third meal.
So the eating and the drinking is supposed to be extremely important and special, as opposed to not.
That's right.
So I was taking your analogy.
Yeah, and because you think it's supposed to be so special, why not make it a feast day? On the other hand, fasting from it allows you the appreciation, the deep appreciation you have for it, and it separates it and makes it distinct from Sabbath, which really is at some level the core here as well. But the notion that we have this deep relationship with it is not surprising, because we are also into feasting as much as we are into fasting, if not more.
I have one little anecdote for you about Shabbat Shabbaton. Until the first class a couple of weeks ago, I always thought Shabbat Shabbaton applied to when Yom Kippur fell on Shabbat only.
Oh, wow.
And I grew up with that.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
I mean, that's really
like
interesting.
This year.
Right, like this year. I could see why.
And never knew it applied.
Yeah, because you might think that the extra oomph of Shabbat within Yom Kippur is like really something.
But perhaps it shouldn't be a direct mapping, it should be an inverted mapping, because Shabbat is onik. It's a delight of Shabbat. This is an affliction.
Right, so maybe we do have to say that we have to do the comparison between a Shabbat and Oneg and versus the Shabbaton of Yom Kippur. Maybe the hint is there, right, to say that's Inui, but this is Oneg. Here's my problem with that. I might come back and say, you're telling me that it's Shabbaton versus Shabbat, Shabbat Oneg versus Inui Nefesh, but since the phrase is used in both Shabbat Shabbaton, over there by Shabbos, and over here by Yom Kippur, I now have to make sense of this, right? And so where the rabbis make sense of it, and I think we'll see it tonight, is that they say malacha applies to both. Don't do malacha. You might have thought, in other words, the hanach of the assumption might have been, you could just perform the Yom Kippur ritual by engaging in these afflictions. No, there's the similarity between the whole day being like a yontif, regardless of whether or not it falls on Shabbat itself. And therefore, you can't do any malacha. Being that Shabbaton comes to teach us that, I still then have to figure out what I do with the rest of the verses that describes Yom Kippur, and therefore Inui Nefesh, which is mentioned five times in the verses we looked at, as the makor, as the root, as the source of Yom Kippur's celebration, those are what distinguish it from any of the Shabbat celebration and the way we keep Shabbat.
So I'd like to suggest another mapping. And I'm not sure, but I'm fairly sure that the three are also connected with warning. That you don't wash when you're in mourning, you don't anoint yourself, and you don't wear shoes.
Okay, very good. So, and the fourth, I'll add, because I was going to present the same. And the bed has an interesting use during mourning. So here's the thing. There's a deep level of mourning here and touch with death. And we're supposed to be in touch with mortality and near death on Yom Kippur. And the fact that we come back to life is a gift, according to one trope of looking at Yom Kippur throughout the sources. All of these are things that I would refrain from doing if I was in mourning myself. The bed itself has flipped over. And we sit on it as our low seat during the mourning period in the ancient world. And we're not to use it for sexual purposes. So there's a lot here where it comes to being in touch deeply with mortality.
Which one is not associated with mourning? Just
the
eating and drinking?
Well, you would say that eating and drinking has its own kind of... There's a special meal for when mourners return from the burial. There's the notion that going into a Shiva house, there's something to eat, that we don't stop eating. There's no fasting during that time.
That's the only two of the list that are not associated.
Not directly the way we directly associated the others. Okay. So...
Can I just ask the general question? How often are there records of how often people actually were excommunicated? I know Spinoza, but beyond that, I don't have a database of whether this was... Never frequently, or something in between?
I mean, we know from certain moments in history that karet was handed down by a Beit Din based on literature, halachic literature of the Middle Ages. Had its own way. Cherem was the more often used because it's a Beit Din of human beings. Karet, remember, was really Beit Dei Shemayim. was in the hands of heaven. So Karet we really don't have records for, and Spinoza's Cherem, excommunication, is a little bit different. And Cherem does have a history that's traceable in literature and in halachic literature, and was really used and is mentioned in the sources. Part of what is Rabbi Dorf has written about this, Professor Newman has written about this, part of what changed for the Jewish people in modernity was for the inability of a Jewish court or Beit Din to issue cherem in the same way as Jews became citizens of nations where it was possible for them. And unless today somebody submits to a Beit Din within his or her neighborhood, let's say, and a cherem, an order of cherem is created, and it matters, we're at a time where it's fundamentally changed.
It just calls to mind when I was in Amsterdam a couple of years ago and went to the very good Jewish museum and they talked about how when the Enlightenment came and Napoleon came, that in fact there was enormous resistance among the rabbis in terms of allowing the community to learn anything other, any other language, because they really wanted to retain their control over the community.
I mean, that was the moment, right? So in the annals of Jewish history, what an incredible time that Napoleon arranges a Sanhedrin of his own, uses the term from our ancient court, and designates certain experts to interrogate the Jewish people if they can truly be citizens of the French nation, follow the law of the land. That's where Dina de Malchuta Dina, the law of the land is a law, arguments about whether or not Jews are really able to follow that and pledge loyalty, quote-unquote, to the flag of their nation versus their nationhood as Am Yisrael. So Those are wonderful debates and records to take a look at. Okay, so let's go back in here. What I want to do is just point out again that the end of this little part said Shvot, and it clues you into something that's going to be discussed in the brightas that we're going to take a look at in the Gemara, and that is, this implies that one must rest and refrain from doing things versus what? Afflict oneself in a proactive manner and inflict pain. Let's go to 74b1 now. So for those in the Ivrit, I'm on line 5 of the Vilna Shas of the page, 74b1, starting on the left side down at the bottom of the column. The Gemara presents. Yeah? Okay, so now the Gemara is going to present a series of brises about the mitzvah of afflicting oneself. And this is where we want to open our channels to say, think of this not only as the straw man, the hava amina. You might say it's this, but really it's that. Right? It is that. But I want to look at it through the lens of ritual development and the truth of the rabbis being able to handle, the Mishnah says we should do this. It might have been a little different if we would have gone with Rabbi Levi's interpretation, who came in from the Galilee and who was at the meeting about Yom Kippur. Ad kedekach, like to that level. I very much can appreciate, we can appreciate, that the Mishnah as it stands, even if you accept it was from Sinai and everything was whispered to Moses, was open to the channels of debate by the rabbis as to really what should be done for Yom Kippur. It's an incredible part of our oral tradition that we had these debates. It doesn't undermine anything to say someone thought we might want to do this when we decided that normative halacha is this. Right? Some people might say it sounds weaker if you present the possibility of it being anything but what we know is halacha, Moshe, le Moshe Misinai, to Moses from Sinai. Look at it a different way. And if you think about it from the divinely inspired genius of religionists whom our ancestors were in touch with through the sages and the movements of these sages, wow, what openness they had about their trying to understand the most basic and most complex manners of living out Torah's commandments in our religious lives, and the meaning that we were to be able to derive from those practices. So the Braita begins like this. Tanu Rabbanan, which is always the introduction of a Braita. Tanu Rabbanan. Tanu et nafshotechem. How do I understand the verse, you should afflict yourselves? Yachol, it could be, yeshev v'chama o vasina kedei sheyitzta'er. I could interpret that verse to mean that one should proactively inflict upon oneself the pain of, the affliction of, sitting in the hot sun or in serious cold in order for the person to suffer. There you go. Sounds very ascetic, right? This is asceticism in this world. This is an ascetic practice. And one should suffer and do it through sitting in the hot sun or being in the severe cold. So let's say you live near the Hermon. And you go all the way up to that snow-top mountain with no shoes on. You know, that's the first question I asked too, Bobby. Where could you do the cold? I was reading today, this afternoon. I was thinking, that's it. It's the guy who lives right near Hermon. V'chol melacha lo tasu. It also says, the verse says, don't do any work. Ma malacha shev v'al taseh, just like malachot, categories of work, require me to not engage in those work, and I use the philosophical principle, the underpinning of what the rabbis say is shev al taseh. You sit and don't do it. You sit and do nothing. You refrain. Just like with malacha, I sit and refrain from doing a certain kind of labor. Af inui nefesh shev al taseh. So too I can understand the language of Torah in regards to Yom Kippur by way of practicing what I need to in order to fulfill the commandments of the day, that they too are refrain from and do not engage in. Now that is, the mitzvah of affliction requires not a direct inflicting of pain and discomfort, but a refraining from any activity. The Gemara asks, "Ve'ema hecha de'yativ b'shimsha ve'chayim lei," but say that the verse means to command that in a case where one sits in the sun and becomes hot, lo ne'ma lei kum tuv betula, that what we refrain from, because the refraining from part was a kind of response to the original suggestion that we have to inflict ourselves with cold and hot to say, wait a minute, really, that's what you're thinking? That malacha is shev al taseh, is refrain from doing nothing, and so too the inui, so too the affliction is refrain and don't engage in the labor, but didn't you just tell me that you're sending him out to inflict upon himself cold or hot? What's going on? What are you really trying to say? What are you saying? No, what I mean is, what you refrain from doing is you don't say, lo neimale, you don't say to him, get up and go into the shade. You're sitting in the sun. Or, yativ betula v'karirle, or when one sits in the shade and becomes cold, lo neimale, you refrain from saying, kum tu b'shimisha, get up and move into the sun. Now, the Gemara is going to answer that and say, Dumya dimalacha, the mitzvah of afflicting oneself, no, is similar to the mitzvah of refraining from work. The way you used it before and the way you're trying to prove it now, like, that doesn't work. It is like that. Ma malachalo chalaktava, just as you do not differentiate concerning when to apply the mitzvah of refraining from work, for it is a prohibition that attaches in all situations. In other words, during the day. You don't do that. As inui lo tachalokbo. I can't say it applies here and it doesn't apply this time, at that time, or in this situation. It simply means you have the possibility of refraining from something on a constant level. So where does this leave it? That sitting in the hot sun or sitting in the cold either is something that now you have to do all day, right? Or the Braita is suggesting that this is not sounding like the exact understanding that we need to have vis-a-vis the Inui Nefesh. This would just not work out.
We also have the issue of having to protect God's creation.
I don't know of a verse that halachically demands it by way of deraita or derabbanan law, but I do know of a verse that you could put up as to make your argument for the point that you're making, and that's v'chai behem. Right? You should live through them. You should live by the mitzvot. The mitzvot should provide for life, not endanger you entirely. Right? Where do we know that the rabbis indeed experienced a Jerusalem snowstorm and worried about the life of one of the potential great sages of the Torah? Hillel. Where was he? He's on the roof. And snow falls and he becomes a popsicle. And they have to take him inside and put him by the fire on Shabbat. Because nefesh docheh et Shabbat, saving life, you know, kind
Did
of...
Did they make the fire? Or was it an existing
well,
fire?
You know, that's a big question. Matter of debate. But here's the thing, Bobby. Yeah. So I just told you about not lighting a fire on Shabbat. It's true. But I would say also that we have to learn the laws of saving a life and that it would allow us to do what we needed to do in order to save any life. So if you're in the game and you understand the distinction that you can make between don't light a fire and what you really need to light a fire for by way of saving lives, that the halacha provides for that, and thank God the tradition really, really does take that seriously. Good, it's a good diuk, it's a good point. I want to point out before we move forward a little bit that on the bottom of that page where we could turn the page and read the whole next braita, what I want to point out is that the next braita simply comes and says, well, maybe by saying you shall afflict yourselves, it could mean that you sit in the sun or the cold, just the same way. I'm now on the top of 74b2. I'm not reading it inside. I'm just going to tell you outside the text. And therefore, the Torah states, you shall do no work. The linking of the two mitzvot teaches, just as a work is an act for which one is liable to karet elsewhere, so to afflicting oneself involves an act for which one is liable to karet elsewhere. In other words, they want to try to figure out, like, are these kinds of practices, the practices we're going to say not only are the ones that are forbidden, but those are the ones that carry the penalty of karet. And the Bryce is going to go on and say, well, I don't know if it's about sitting in the cold or sitting in the hot sun. It might be about refraining from eating a certain type of food on Yom Kippur. And I have to be really careful about offerings that I'm going to bring and food that was left over from other offerings and whether or not I was going to think about eating it when not in its own time. And I don't want to get into the full details of all that. But it's really about then that's the transition, Brita, from it went from suggesting that you should sit in the sun and bake there all day to sitting in the cold and figuring out whether or not that sounds like a malacha shev ba'al taseh, it fits the category of sit, refrain from doing this, and really do nothing and having it apply the whole time. To this next writer that says, okay, maybe those work, but maybe better are afflictions that have to deal with certain types of food that is on the mizbeach, on the altar of the temple, and that I have to be very careful if I have something that's sacrificed for this purpose, and I say I'm going to eat it after its prescribed time, I have to afflict myself with that. But then it even goes further and says sacrificial meat that's left over, and talks about different kinds of meat on the altar. And then at the end of that section that I don't want to go into directly, go to the last line, literally the last line on the right-hand column of 74b2. Ve'im nafshecha lomar is where I am. It's on almost the last narrow line in the Gemara if you're in the Vilna Shas on Ayin Dalet Bet. It's on line 31 of the page, just before the wider lines. Ve'im nafshecha lomar, if you have a desire to say that, in other words, the scriptural source that establishes the mitzvah of afflicting oneself on Yom Kippur really does mean eating and drinking. And you just went through all this to say it's about eating and drinking all kinds of different offerings on the Mizbeach, on the altar, and all the specific kinds of foods that are up there, and you have to be ultra careful. Harehu Omer, I will tell you that the verse states the following, V'ha'avadati et ha'nefesh ha'hi, and I will destroy that soul that does any of this eating. Inui shehu aveda ha'nefesh, this teaches that in general, the affliction required on Yom Kippur is one that is tantamount to the, here's translated as diminution of the life force, the quote-unquote lessening your soul force, taking a little bit of your life away from you. What's a better way to translate that? Reducing your vitality. And what is the best affliction that I could come up with that helps us reduce vitality? Now using vitality in this kind of soul-informed, infused way. That is ze achila v'shtia. That is eating and drinking. It's not about whether or not you ate leftover korbanot meat and you included the pigul, the meat you intended to eat from the korban that you weren't supposed to eat, or the fat parts thereof, or all these little details of korbanot. It's in general. The best way to reduce vitality, to la'anot et ha'nefesh, is to understand that we're talking in general about that which reduces your feeling a life force within you, and that is achila v'shtia. That is not, back to the beginning of the Braita, sitting in the hot sun or being in the cold.
The problem, sitting in the hot sun or cold, the problem is there, the sticks up something, right? Here you don't have it. It's resisting one soul will just as well work for sitting in hot sun or cold. But the problem there was the Shesher Adaseh, right? Here, that's the way I understand it.
I think that the Sheva Al Taseh issue over here, in other words, that you refrain from on a constant basis the eating and the drinking, is assumed within the end of the Braita, that it's no longer part of the inyan. Over there, they had an issue with that saying,
right.
What you have to do to fulfill your mitzvah on Yom Kippur, according to that very first Braita we read, is you have to refrain from telling your neighbor, get up and move into the shade, or get out of the cold, you're going to kill yourself. That made no sense to them. Again, the next Braita comes. Maybe it's sitting in the cold and in the sun. We're not even going to get into the issue of what you say or you don't say to somebody. Now we're going to say it has to deal with refraining entirely from eating certain types of meat and offerings on the Mizbeach. And then the Braita comes and says, but you might say that the whole point of this, now I understand it, not even about the Sheva Al Taseh philosophy, is that I want an affliction that reduces one's vitality. Yeah. So that's where I see it.
You said they lived in a Galenic world. You know, Galen is 135 AD. And the whole issue of that world, obviously, was a world of humors and connecting up vital humors to the elements of the earth and the four seasons. There was a very complex worldview, but from sort of a physiologic standpoint, talking about vitality, they believed that the food went to the liver, where it made all of the blood,
and
then that went out to the rest of the body, and all of that blood was consumed each day. This is pre-harving, so there's no notion of a closed circulatory system. So they believed that there needed to be replenishment of all of the tissues each day, from the food getting converted into blood and then getting pushed out to the periphery. Then there was also the air, the pneuma, which created a vital spirit that mixed with the blood in the left ventricle, and that had very special vitalistic properties. So I don't know exactly what the connections were, but we're 200 AD, and clearly these ideas were definitely in the air in terms of the medical world.
Right, well, dates-wise, Barry's saying that in 200, that was the editorship of the Mishnah. This Braita could be from the same time or before that. And whether or not they really are linking v'ha'avadati et ha-nefesh ahi, that loss of vitality from the nefesh, from the soul, to this, would be a really fascinating investigation to see if there's any shared language in he's writing in Greek at the time, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
He's in modern-day Turkey. He's, you know, in...
Yeah, but he's writing in Greek.
Yeah.
And so it'd be a fascinating look to see if the Septuagint, the Greek translation of Torah, shared any language with him, and that the rabbis kind of used verbs that really were linked in.
So he lived in Pergamon. So went to the Met Show, or went to Berlin to see the Pergamon altar. That's
nice.
That's where Galen.
Very interesting. Yeah, Robbie.
So I'm thinking of something much more modern and contemporary, and there's so much of an exploration now of the idea of mindfulness, So which I don't know that much about, but it seems to me as though all of these things that they're eliminating, and we know that from Yom Kippur, helps us to be more mindful. It takes away distractions, even work, you know, all of those things. Kind of take away from the focus that we're supposed to be doing. So, you know, that vitality or whatever, it's a vitality that takes away from a more meditative, contemplative mindfulness that is, I think, the elation you feel at the end of the Yom Kippur session. So it seems to me as though a long time ago they figured out what things would deflect from the idea of being focused and mindful and really being much more laser-like in terms of concentration.
I'll add a dimension to what kind of mindfulness was always kind of present to me in these passages, and again struck me as I was rereading. And Jewish mindfulness, in my estimation, being a little bit different than mindfulness of the present only, kind of my existence, my breath, not that kind of Eastern mindfulness, but a dimensional mindfulness that has at its core certain pillar ideas, or let's say poles of attraction beyond just two poles. And it starts with noting where we are in the brightas, okay? So we started on 74B1, you don't need to turn there. I'll just remind you that we were talking about cold and hot. I saw this as presenting a possibility to be mindful of the following, beginning brighter. Be mindful of the elements that you encounter in the world, the cold and the hot. The, you know, way we used to look at poetry in school, humans versus the world, man versus the world. That if you look at that brighta as introducing man versus nature kind of theme, I've got one element within my Yom Kippur experience that I'm going to focus upon. That's one pole. I turn, and I describe to you the brighta of debating about all kinds of prohibitions regarding pigul, nosar, tevel, different parts of the sacrificial systems, meats and eats that I have to be careful about. And there I'm thrust into temple history, relationship to the Beit HaMikdash, the place God will choose. And the temple and Jerusalem come significantly into focus for me. Jewish mindfulness. I'm ridding myself of the eating, the drinking, the everydayness of my life, and I'm now, yes, reducing my vitality vis-a-vis the kind of production of blood I need for the day, if that was their kavanah. I'm thinking about nature, my place in the world, physical world. I'm thinking about the temple, Jerusalem. And I'm going to demonstrate, I think, that there are other core focal points, core poles, specific poles that come into focus as well in the next passages. And they will be an encounter with Jewish history beyond the temple, my place in that as a Jewish individual, the idea of Poteach et yadecha umasbi lechol chayratzon, I open my hand and I try to satiate everyone. Hunger. Some of you will say this is a recurring theme with him. But it's not me. It's in the text all the time. It's going to lead us to figure out how we become agents of God to relieve hunger. This is an extremely important issue for the rabbis in so many contexts. This one specifically, that Yom Kippur, by way of the fasting, is connected to that issue as well. And then I want to talk about how there's an aesthetic aspect explored here, that our encounter with the world should have a certain level of beauty, a la the encounter with philosophies of aesthetics and beauty that started in, you know, before their time and in Greece, and the notion how that influences and impacts the world around us. Which is why maybe there's white on Yom Kippur, and then there's a blossoming of color after stepping out of that grandness of white and the blood, though, as the force of red and life and vitality, and then the rest of the world, Begivun, in all its varieties. I think all of that is in here. in the next texts and becomes evident that the rabbis want us to think about these Yom Kippur rituals as relating to these areas philosophically and essentially religiously as Jews. So let's do the history one. Listen to where it goes from here. The next is right on side 74b3. We're here. The Gemara offers a different proof that the affliction of Yom Kippur is abstinence from eating and drinking. So now we have a different proof. But this is the one that's going to deal with history. Divei Rabbi Yishmael Tana, a sage from the Academy of Rabbi Yishmael taught in a Braita. Ne'emar kani nui. The term affliction is stated here in reference to Yom Kippur. Ve'ne'emar lahalani nui. And the term is used over there, affliction. That relates to Deuteronomy. He afflicted you and let you hunger. And where was that? In the desert, in the wilderness. Malahalani nui re'avon. Just like there was an affliction of hunger over here in the desert because God knew you were hungry. And by the way, this is the part about the man. Whoa. Usually that's not on so loud.
Bat kol. It was bat kol.
Okay, so Mala Halan.
Hello, babe. Good night. Hello, good night.
Okay, that was supposed to be an emergency channel, but I guess it's just being used for communication now, which is why my ears pricked up. Okay, so let me go back. Rabbi Yishmael taught in a Braita that I have the term affliction over here by Yom Kippur. And since I have the same verb used or the same noun from the verbal root ayin, right? Inui. Ana, lanot. I'm going to say that it was like a inui in the wilderness, and God provided you man, right? That's just the bonus, but the real inui was you were hungry. You were in the wilderness, and you were hungry. And you were pining after something good to eat. And God created the man, afkan inui ra'avon. So like you were hungry in the wilderness, so too you're hungry here on Yom Kippur. Now the Gemara challenges it. V'nelaf me. But instead of using that verse or the concept of the man in the wilderness answering the deep hunger you have, because I want to see man in the wilderness as some kind of miracle, and God satiating his children, how can I possibly hold that up as the ra'avon, as the hunger? Let's learn it from a different place. Im tanei et binotai. Let us derive instead the definition of affliction as it relates to Yom Kippur from if you will afflict my daughters. And there, that's Lavan demanded that his son-in-law Jacob swear that he not afflict Lavan's daughters by withholding marital relations from them. Accordingly, it means abstinence from cohabitation. Because that's what that whole episode was about. Not from food and drink. Ah, that's still in our list, right? The Gemara answers, Danini nui derabim, inui derabim. You have to derive an affliction for the entire public based on an affliction of the entire public. And since the entire Am Yisrael was in the wilderness and had such an affliction of hunger that God needed to answer yes with man, but they had the affliction of hunger, so too I'm going to learn that the affliction on Yom Kippur for all of the congregation is the hunger that is created through the fasting and the refraining from drinking. Gemara persists in the challenge. V'nelaf mi'inui de Mitzrayim. But let's learn it from a different affliction. That is, you know, I don't need that verse about the wilderness and the whole hunger that happened in the wilderness. I can learn it from the affliction that the Jewish people felt in Egypt. Dichtiv vayar et onyenu. That satisfies your needing to have a situation that applies to the entirety of the nation. And that seems to me to be the better affliction if you want to say the affliction is about a people. And v'amarinan, and in explicating the verse, we've already said, zo prishut derech eretz, and that is keeping men and women away from each other, no use of the bed. In this case, derech eretz does not mean good manners. It's the kinui, it's the saying that we use for the way of all the world, that is, that they husbands and wives get into bed together and they have families. And in Egypt, they didn't do that. The Gemara concedes that this derivation is feasible, but suggests the following: Eila dani inui b'yedei shemayim, inui b'yedei shemayim. Rather, we derive an affliction by the hand of heaven from an affliction by the hand of heaven. And don't tell me that the affliction in Egypt was by the hand of heaven. We know who was responsible for the affliction that men and women were separated and kept from being with each other in Egypt. Who did that? Pharaoh. And since Pharaoh oppressed us like this, we can't learn an inui for Yom Kippur like this, because Yom Kippur is a day that God's supposed to be the one to inflict the affliction on us. Therefore, we say, by the hand of heaven, which is what? The Ravon in the wilderness, the hunger in the wilderness. From that affliction, I learn Ravon, the hunger, is the affliction that I want to have for Yom Kippur, Ravon, and therefore, Ein dani inui b'yedei shemayim, inui b'yedei b'nei adam. I don't really take it that Pharaoh could have done this, so therefore, when God did the Ravon, I can now say the Ravon that I need, or the affliction that I need to understand, is inui inui, from that Ravon in the wilderness, the Ravon that I need in the Yom Kippur ritual. I'm left with, at the end of that passage, an understanding that God inflicted hunger, both in terms of the wilderness and in terms of Yom Kippur, in order to what? In order to la'anot otanu, right? But what if Egypt and the wilderness, right? Because the whole story about being in the wilderness and being hungry is being taken out of Egypt, being in the wilderness, being made to be hungry, and then getting them out. It's about redemption, and it's about what? God's provision. It's all, then our fasting becomes connected to the story of Yitzhak Mitzrayim, to the story of going out of Egypt, to the story of Bamidbar, in the wilderness, the reception from God of the gift of man, and whether we liked it or not, or if it tasted like good corned beef, this is up for debate. If you're a vegetarian, excuse me. It's supposed to taste like anything you want it to. Outside of what? Outside of leeks, garlic, and onions. Now, tell a good Ashkenazic Jew that it can't taste like garlic. It doesn't feel like really big, good redemption. Or onions, right? I mean, the two of them together are like heaven, right? Somehow that midrash, I don't know. It made it in there. What can you do?
Maybe they meant raw.
Yeah, maybe. But the reality stands.
No, what did you say?
No, I said maybe just they meant raw. Because that's...
What's that?
God also sent the plague on them.
That's right.
It's another affliction that came from God.
But by way of looking at it from a literary lens, what I've done now is I've taken Inui. I've explored whether or not it was hot, cold. I have the theme of humans and nature. I've talked about whether or not it's connected to temple and Jerusalem ritual. I've taken it out of that. I want to interpret Inui from the hands of heaven, and I want to bring it into the realm of really connecting to the story of going out of Egypt, God's redemption, provision of man, and taking care of us in the desert when we're hungry. Thematically, I'm getting lots of rich pillars of our tradition here to make my Yom Kippur experience so much more developed. You know, I'm letting this steep. And that's what I think being a great student of the Gemara really helps us do in so many cases. That when we really look into the Gemara for the encounter with what they're talking about vis-a-vis the ritual, we really understand. And Re'avon, hunger, as a word, was not used until now. And even though it's supposed to clear our minds, maybe we are supposed to think about Re'avon, about hunger. And the next piece will go further in that direction, and it will say the Gemara is now going to cite the Amoraic dispute regarding the affliction caused by the man. Ha machilcha man b'midbar, the one who feeds you man in the wilderness, l'ma'an anotcha, in order to afflict you. So that's the Torah in Deuteronomy. What does that mean, the one who feeds you man in the wilderness in order to afflict you? How is right? How is feeding you man the affliction? Right? No, the affliction is, according to the Rishonim, the everyday hunger that you're going to experience. God is going to make sure that you understand that what you're getting is enough man to satiate your hunger here and now. But unlike Shabbat, where you get it for a double portion, you're actually going to experience some hunger. And in a certain way, it sounds cruel. Why should we experience hunger like that? It's a reminder that without God providing, in this case, man, without God providing the earth in which you can grow your crops, without God providing the forces of nature that will allow us to create the systems of both the food itself and distribution thereafter, without that, you'd be nowhere. You'd be hungry. You wouldn't live. And that is expressed by Hashem noten b'chol yom et haman, b'chol eit shel re'avon. God gives the food at every time that there is a quote-unquote hunger in the world. V'gam ata tachshov, and you should think, eich la'achil acherim. And that is that it should translate to how you wind up feeding others. Remember we had in the Tosefta that we looked at? The whole debate about whether or not we were feeding our children and whether it was legal, right? So some of that vocabulary, I think, comes in from the notion of the reading of the Tosefta and is borrowed from over there as well. Like, you're like God providing, lahavdil. You're not God. But you have to do this job, and you can't say it's a source forbidden for me to feed my child. You have to do that because like God fed his children, so too shall you feed. And by the way, today you're going to be hungry like you were in the wilderness, and you're going to remember your being born of your family in the wilderness, born into a people, and God provided for you each time you were hungry. And you must then, in turn, coming out of Yom Kippur, commit yourselves to that activity in the world of feeding those who are hungry. And again, now another pole, another pillar, another focal point for us in our really living out the kedusha of Yom Kippur in the world as we know it. We've gone from human beings and nature, man versus nature. We've gone to Jerusalem and the temple, the existence of how we make sacred and keep sacred boundaries and see the avodah of the Beit HaMikdash, the great ritual of the Beit HaMikdash, as essential, important, and focusing on that which we are permitted to do there, which we must respect there, right, which will work its way into Yom Kippur liturgy explicitly. We see that the Braita went to trying to then say in general about vitality and understanding life force, and we're gonna lessen that to appreciate it deeply, to then thinking about history and being in the wilderness, to the whole notion of family life and whether or not my first understanding of this Inui and the Inui that holds the punishment of karet, of excommunication, Bidei Shamayim, is really about sexual relationships and the Tashmish Hamita, and that's rejected, and we're back to the food piece, and we're back to, no, every time you're really hungry, you have to trust that God will be there, and so too will you be there every time there are hunger needs among your people and in the world. And it goes so far, last paragraph for tonight, I see, and then we'll open up with the other article the next time. And we'll talk more about the history, the great ritual history of these practices that we talked about tonight. The Amoraic dispute on 74b3, who feeds you manna in the wilderness in order to afflict you, Rabbi Ami and Rabbi Asi, they debate why eating manna was an affliction at all. Chad Amar, Eino Dome, Mishi Eshlo Pat Besalo, one who has bread in his basket is not at all similar. Lamisha ain lo pat besalo, to one who does not have bread in his basket. V'chad amar, and one said, Eino dome misha ro'eva ochel, one who sees and eats is not at all similar. Lamisha eino ro'eva ochel, to one who cannot see and eats. Meaning, on the very simple pshat level, behold, there's a beautiful, bountiful plate of food in front of you. It should have an aesthetic kind of sense of, and it should be inviting and enticing. It should raise your level of bateavon, of appetite, and it's so much the sweeter then, right? Beautiful foods make a difference, even if you're not seeing by way of, you know, your ability to see if you're blind. Beautiful food, bountiful food, and by the way, it makes a difference if you've got bread in your basket and none at all. Be reminded that some have none. Like you have none today on Yom Kippur. And so all this is creating a very textured encounter with the rituals of the day. And as I said, I have an article for you which we'll hold on to for the next time. I'm going to put it right here. We'll open with it. And we'll talk about Yom Kippur in the Qumran scrolls and Second Temple literature outside of even the books we've discussed so far. So we'll trace a little bit of what's going on and quote-unquote how we got there. And in none of them, by the way, for the Jewish side of the world, is anybody saying that you should sit beneath a heat lamp or take your shoes off and run to a snow-capped mountain.
Thank you.
I would hope.
In that regard, are some of these arguments raised for the purpose of being refuted? They're not serious about it?
I suggested in what I said right there, one could say, these are simply straw men. These are havaminas. These are possibilities that are put forward to knock them down in the kind of Talmudic logical argumentation that exists. But I don't see that as the, you know, kind of simple. I don't see that as the way that the rabbis are developing their argumentation. I think the rabbis are much more deeply involved in debating some of what were core ritual ideas extant at the time, maybe in their own community, maybe in their environs among other sects or peoples. And so you really do see that it's much more complex than simply, let me, you know, suggest this novel interpretation in order to offer my own.
But you did base part of your teaching on what was rejected, not just what was accepted.
That's right. It's not even a thesis. You mean noticing the points of focus.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say that the focus.
Yep.